It's now my honor to introduce tonight's guest. Mayin Arikat is the PLO representative to the United States. Prior to his appointment to Washington, Mr. Arikat served for 11 years at the Negotiations Affairs Department of the PLO in Ramallah, most recently as its deputy head and coordinator general. Previously, Mr. Arikat was responsible for overseeing the work of the Negotiations Support Unit, which provides legal, policy, communications, and technical support to Palestinian negotiating teams and to the Palestinian leadership. He took part in numerous Palestinian-Israeli negotiations in Gaza, Taba, and Jerusalem, and was an official member of the Palestinian delegation at the Y River negotiations in 1998. He recently returned from Bethlehem, where Fatah held its first party conference in 20 years and elected a mostly new leadership committee. No stranger to the United States, Mr. Arikat earned his Bachelor of Science from Arizona State University and his MBA from Western International University. He also completed a course in good governance at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. So here tonight to discuss with us a full range of issues concerning the Palestinian people, Middle East, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the PLO representative to the United States, Mayin Arikat. Mr. Arikat, welcome, and we're very pleased to have you as our guest.
Thank you.
I want to start out with something very basic that I think all of us need a background in: governance of the Palestinian people. Could you tell us a little bit, what is the Palestine Liberation Organization? What's the Palestinian National Authority? What's the role of the Prime Minister, President, Parliament? In a few words.
In a few words. Okay. Well, the Palestine Liberation Organization is the legitimate and sole representative of the Palestinian people. It was established in 1968 to include all the various Palestinian factions who were fighting, struggling to regain or get independence for the Palestinian people from the Israeli occupation. And it got its official recognition at the Rabat Arab Summit that was held in Morocco in 1974, when all the Arab countries recognized the PLO to be the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. The PLO is a secular organization, included at one time factions that represented the far left during the days of the 70s. Fatah is the largest faction within the PLO. And it was the PLO which eventually decided to engage Israel in negotiations towards the end of the 80s and early in the 90s, that culminated in an agreement, the Oslo Accord, between the PLO and Israel in 1993. As a result of that agreement, the PLO Executive Committee met and decided to establish the Palestinian National Authority. The Palestinian National Authority was established to take control of areas that Israel was supposed to turn over to the Palestinian, to the Palestinians as a result of the Oslo Accord of 1993. So politically, the PLO is the highest executive branch in the Palestinian political establishment or system. Only the Palestine National Council is higher because it's the highest legislative body. The Palestine National Council, the PNC, represent Palestinians all over, including those who live under Israeli occupation and those who are in the diaspora in this country and elsewhere. So if you have the PNC as the highest legislative authority, the PLO as the highest political authority, then the Palestine National Authority was the executive branch produced by the PLO to take control of areas that Israel planned to withdraw from as a result of the Oslo Accord of 1993, and which also stipulated the elections of 1996, the first elections to elect the Palestinian Legislative Council. So now you have a byproduct of the Oslo Accord, the Palestinian National Authority and the Palestinian Legislative Council, both only representing Palestinians who lived in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. They do not represent the overall Palestinian population around the world. The prime minister position was only introduced in 2003. And before that, the president, the late President Arafat, almost assumed the responsibilities of being both the president of the Palestinian National Authority and the prime minister. Until 2003, the Palestinian Authority decided to create the position of the prime minister, and it was President Mahmoud Abbas, who is now the president, who became the first prime minister of the Palestinian National Authority. Now, of course, it's Prime Minister Salam Fayyad. And his duties is to oversee the policies of the Palestinian Authority inside the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. It does not extend to outside those territory. I hope
it was... Good start. Thank you. And, of course, Hamas won a significant victory in terms of their parliamentary seats and became the de facto government of Gaza, while Fatah is governing the West Bank. Can you just give us an idea of how the two now relate within the Palestinian Authority?
Well, Hamas took over after they won the elections of 2006. As you notice, the first elections were held in 1996. The second elections, the Legislative Council elections, were delayed. Instead of being held in 2000, the events of the second Palestinian Intifada delayed the elections until 2006, and Hamas won the elections by more than 70%, 60% of the vote. There was a smooth transfer of authority at the time. Fatah, and after ruling the Palestinian people for such a long time, it's true it was difficult for some to accept the fact that Hamas won. It was a surprise. People expected Hamas to perform well, but nobody expected Hamas to score high in these elections. And we can maybe elaborate later on the reasons why Hamas scored high in these elections. The first sticking point or the point of friction between the president and the newly elected Hamas government or faction was the need for any future government to adhere to the policies and the political agenda of the president. According to the Palestinian Basic Law, there is no Palestinian government in a vacuum. It is the government of the president. That's how the Basic Law defines the government. It's the government that represents the president of the Palestinian National Authority and execute the policies of the president of the Palestinian National Authority. The point of contention was that if you want to govern, you have to respect the obligations, the agreements, the responsibilities of the Palestinian Authority that, you know, were signed in the past, including, most importantly, the Oslo Agreement that, allowed for these elections to happen and for Hamas to win the elections. The president had the choice early in the process to submit what we call a letter of assignment to the prime minister, the new prime minister at the time, which was Mr. Ismail Haniyeh, and asking him to meet 1, 2, 3. And if he refuses to say, well, you know, since you don't want to implement my policy, you no longer represent me, and therefore I'm not going to assign you to form the new government. The president opted against the advice of many to give that government the opportunity to be in power, hoping that the fact that they will be in power will make them understand the realities facing the Palestinian people and somehow accommodate to the new realities. This, of course, did not happen, in addition to complications that were created by Israel, who immediately declared the Palestinian Authority as illegitimate, not dealing with them, and then pressure from the international community, interference in the internal Palestinian affairs that really complicated the matter further and led later, unfortunately, to the division that we are seeing right now.
So it's several years later.
Several years later now, the government, as a result of the embargoes that was imposed on the Palestinian Authority, the financial sanctions by Europe, by the international community, crippled basically the Palestinian society and made things very difficult and led, of course, to major disagreements between the presidency and the prime minister. The PLC was paralyzed, did not convene at all to introduce any bills, and the whole Palestinian political system almost reached a standstill, and there was nothing happening in that regard until 2006, with the unfortunate developments in Gaza and the permanent division that we see, the physical and political division between the West Bank and Gaza right now, which we hope will soon end, and the two parties will be able to reconcile again.
Egypt has been negotiating with Hamas and Fatah, and there have been a number of areas of agreement that reached and some areas of disagreement. Can you talk a little bit about those negotiations?
Well, Egypt has been trying actually for the last 2-3 years to end the divisions between mainly between Fatah and Hamas, and in order to allow the Palestinians once again to reconcile and present a united front, vis-a-vis all the challenges that are facing the Palestinian people. The Egyptian paper that was submitted 2 weeks ago to the Palestinian side was accepted by Fatah. And the Palestinian leadership sent an envoy to Cairo to inform the Egyptian leadership that Fatah and the PLO have accepted the Egyptian paper. Unfortunately, despite earlier indications from Hamas that they will approve the Egyptian paper, there has been a change of mind and a position in the last minute that led to Hamas expressing reservations about the Egyptian paper and leading to the failure of not signing the paper as we were all expecting.
But didn't the PLO announce that the elections would be held much earlier than had been desired by Hamas, no. January 24th rather than mid-year next year?
From the beginning, the president made it clear that the only way he will postpone the elections if there is a national reconciliation agreement. For us, the issue of the election is very crucial and very important. It impacts the overall the Palestinian democratic process. These elections were postponed, the presidential election particularly, were postponed by 1 year as a result of the death of the late President Arafat. When President Abu Mazen was elected, he was elected not in conjunction with the Legislative Council elections. And they said, when they amended the Basic Law, that the election of President Abbas in 2005 were held separately only for this exceptional time, and that in the future both the Legislative Council elections and the presidential elections should be held simultaneously. This was a point of disagreement last year, if you remember, when Hamas kept calling on the president to step down, saying that his term ended last June. And then, they stopped demanding that, and the president now, into his fifth year, when the law asked him to only stay for 4 years, I think it's very important that we preserve this democratic process. It's important that we adhere to the basic law, which says that this election should be held January 25th, 2010. According to the law, the president must announce the elections 3 months before they take place. This is exactly what he said. Now, if things happen, developments take place, and there is an opportunity, a chance for reconciliation, I'm sure that there will be flexibility about the timing. The Egyptian paper originally proposed the first half of 2010, but given that everything is agreed, in the absence of an agreement, we cannot take our people to a constitutional democratic vacuum.
And now there's a new issue. The Human Rights Council report that accused Israel and, I suppose, to some extent, Hamas of committing war crimes during the military offensive in Gaza last year. And I gather that Hamas has created a furor, is furious over the way in which this was tabled at the Human Rights Council with the apparent support of President Abbas. The report is now headed to the UN General Assembly, possibly the Security Council, the International Criminal Court. So I have a couple of questions. Do you feel that this fury is going to affect the parliamentary election? And secondly, what do you expect will be the outcome of this report moving along?
Well, first of all, one can understand why Hamas was upset with the fact that the report somehow it tried to equate the aggressor and the victim. And when you look at the toll of a human casualty and the destruction that was caused by the Israeli war against Gaza last December, 1,500 Palestinians killed, thousands wounded, almost total destruction of the Strip. And in return for, few casualties on the Israeli side, don't misunderstand me. I'm not condoning any of these actions by either party. But, they had some legitimate reason for feeling that they've been treated unfairly. You know, when you compare the use of excessive force and destruction and brutality to attempts on the part of Hamas to defend themselves and to defend the population, you see the imbalance in that report. But I have to say that the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian leadership did not call for the withdrawal of the report. After consultations with many parties, including many Arab countries who later criticized the Palestinian leadership accepting to postpone it. The idea is to try to postpone it until a later time, because we were concerned about efforts being exerted, particularly by the United States administration, to water down the resolution and somehow declaw it from some of its clauses that were needed to make it effective. Now, in the process, we admitted, as a Palestinian authority and the Palestinian leadership, that we made a mistake in requesting the postponement of the agreement. We have been subjected to very harsh criticism as a result. First and foremost from our people. And responded to that criticism and that pressure from our people, and we reintroduced the report, which passed the Human Rights Council, and now we are contemplating the chances of presenting that report to the UN Security Council. In order to put it on the table, you need to have the vote of 9 Security Council members to be discussed. Now, if it doesn't, I think the United Nations General Assembly is another venue, and we will see how things will progress. As for this impacting the elections, I don't know. The elections will be held, if they are held on time, they will be held on January 25th. We still 3 months to go from now. many, many things can happen in between that could impact the elections. So I cannot predict whether they will have an impact or not.
Do you think that Mahmoud Abbas has the political support to really make a peace commitment if he wants to?
Well, I think Mahmoud Abbas is a genuine leader. At least he says in public what he says in private. He believes very much that peace is an objective, a goal for the Palestinian people to realize, a dignified peace, not any peace. I think he is very, very clear and he has a very clear vision about how things should progress with the Israelis. He makes his positions clear to people that he meets with, and he represents the Palestinian national aspiration in a very, very true and honest manner. He understands that there has to be an end to this conflict. An end to a conflict once and for all that will allow future generations of Palestinians and Israelis to live in peace, dignity, freedom, and liberty. And I think he is going to continue to do that. Now, his task is not easy, but he is driven by the desire to see an end to that conflict and a just resolution to the Arab-Israeli conflict in general.
Given Hamas's position on the existence of Israel, how can Abbas represent them in a peace negotiation?
Well, Hamas as a faction is entitled for whatever political position they want to adopt. In our discussions with Hamas, we don't ask Hamas to recognize Israel. We don't tell them to recognize Israel. That they are a political faction, a political party that they can believe in whatever they want, similar to what you have in Israel. You have parties in Israel that are advocating the transfer of the Palestinians out of their country, and they are part of the current coalition government of Israel. So we are not asking Hamas to change its political agenda, political platform. We are telling Hamas, if you want to join a government led by the PLO, by the Palestinian National Authority, you have to adhere to the political agenda of the PLO and to the Palestinian National Authority. You cannot join the government and carry out policies that are contradictory to the policies of the Palestinian Authority and the PLO. Now, as a political faction, this is something up to Hamas to decide if they want to change their policies vis-a-vis Israel. But once they become part of the Palestinian political system, they have to adhere and respect the obligations of the Palestinian National Authority and the PLO.
Do you feel that your authority is in a position to guarantee the security of Palestine and prevent any intervention in Israel?
Well, this is two different questions here. The Palestinian Authority is doing a lot in order to guarantee the security of the Palestinian population. I think any visitor to Palestine, to the West Bank, can easily notice the difference on the ground in terms of the role of the security forces in maintaining law and order. For the first time ever, you walk in the streets and you feel safe. You know that there is a security authority that protects the Palestinian population. This is a Palestinian interest. We are not doing that to please Israel or to please the United States. This is a Palestinian national interest. We need to provide our people with a sense of security, sense of safety, so that they can live in peace and security in their own homes and in their own towns and cities. Now, as for the other part, I don't think it's fair to ask the Palestinians to provide security for Israel. I think we should ask Israel to provide security for the Palestinians, because they are the stronger party in this conflict. And for us to ask us to provide security and guarantee the security of Israel is really something unacceptable to us. But we are willing, in a future agreement with Israel, to provide Israel with whatever guarantees they need to make sure that they feel safe and secured. But under no circumstances will the Palestinians accept, after a peace agreement with Israel, for one single Israeli soldier to stay on the national soil of the future Palestinian state. We can look into any different arrangement international forces, European forces, NATO, what have you. But anything short of a physical military Israeli presence on future Palestinian soil.
Would you declare that you will not have a military force yourselves?
We have to have a military force. We will not have an offensive military force. But the concept of a demilitarized state does not exist in international law anyhow. When you heard Netanyahu saying that I have two conditions for accepting a Palestinian state, that they have to recognize the Jewish nature of the state of Israel and that the future Palestinian state has to be demilitarized. What he meant with demilitarized, not only demilitarized in the military sense, he wanted a demilitarized state that would not have control over its airspace, will not have control over its electromagnetic sphere, will not have control over its international crossing borders, will not have control over its territorial waters. He wanted a protectorate, basically. So I would say that instead of demilitarized, we should have a non-militarized state, i.e. something similar to what happened to Japan and Germany and Switzerland. You need to have a strong national security forces to maintain law and order and to be able to protect your own population. But the extent of that armament can be discussed, and we are willing to do that. We don't want to spend billions of dollars on getting an air force and an army when we know that we are surrounded by neighbors who can easily defeat us, and we will never be able to be a match to them. So we are very much aware of this fact.
But Israel voluntarily pulled out of both occupied Lebanon and Gaza, and in both cases, departure was followed by armed attacks, by rocket attacks. So what reason is there for Israel to withdraw from the West Bank, which is much closer to the population centers?
The reason is to prevent these attacks. That's why there are continued attacks, because the problem has not been resolved. When they pulled out of Lebanon, do you think they pulled out of Lebanon without leaving so many deep wounds among the Lebanese people there that they inflicted on the people there for 20 years of occupation? This is the result of occupation. That's what occupation does to people. When they rule another people against their will, when they humiliate them on a daily basis, when they violate their human rights and civil rights, They create hatred in the hearts of people that are being subjugated to military occupation. I think in order to prevent future attacks, Israel needs to end its occupation and immediately.
Let me ask you about the feasibility of creating a Palestinian state. The population continues to increase. Poverty continues and maybe increasing as well in the Palestinian territories. What's the basis for believing that a Palestinian nation could survive economically?
Well, first of all, the Palestinian people are very, very highly educated people. They are very skilled people, and they have a lot of potential. Palestine has a lot of potential absent the Israeli military occupation. A major source of the economic hardships that we have is Israeli policies in Palestine. The closure of the Palestinian areas, the restrictions of the freedom of movement of people, goods and services. The World Bank a few years ago came out with a report saying that if Israel lifts all their closure from the Palestinian areas, the Palestinian economy can be self-reliant. We will not need international support. I think we have so many important sectors in Palestine, agriculture, tourism, services, banking, that we can really build a very strong economy. But you cannot do that when you are under occupation, when the investment environment is unpredictable, when your economy is very much dependent on foreign aid. I think I'm not going to blame the Israeli military occupation for all our ills and problems. I mean, this would not be logical. We have our own shortcomings and mistakes as well. But I think a major step to improve the Palestinian economy and allow the Palestinians to prove themselves is for the Israelis to end their occupation of the Palestinian people.
It was mentioned earlier that Prime Minister Olmert, former Prime Minister Olmert, was a speaker here at this forum. And on that occasion, he mentioned that he had had 35 meetings with Abu Mazen. And on September 16th last year, he proposed a comprehensive peace plan. He proposed a settlement of territory based on 1967 borders with land exchanges based on what had happened since. And he showed a map that he was interested in having Abu Mazen review and agree to. He also talked about safe passage between Gaza and the West Bank, of Arabs and Jews, sharing Jerusalem as a capital of both nations, and there would be Arab and Jewish neighborhoods that would remain intact, and then the Holy Basin would be under the consortium of five nations. And he also talked about security and refugees, and he asked Abu Mazen to agree to it. And Abu Mazen, after these 35 meetings and with a presentation of what he considered a comprehensive peace plan, said, well, he didn't really know about maps. He'd like his map expert to take a look at it, and perhaps his aide and the map expert could meet with Olmert's map expert and his aide, and they should get together tomorrow. And Olmert agreed, and claims that the next day President Abbas contacted him and said, we're going to have to delay it. We can't make the date today. And he said that was the last time he had seen your president. He never heard from him again. And he said, as far as he's concerned, that was a plan that should be on the table today and should be the working plan for peace. And he wants to know what happened. Why didn't he get a return call and visit?
Well, the map person that Olmert was referring to, someone who works with our team. And let me say something first about Olmert. I think Olmert did try to engage with us on a lot of issues, and he believed in the sense of urgency of reaching a resolution to the conflict, contrary to the current Israeli Prime Minister, who seems to be relying very much on public relations and propaganda rather than engaging in serious, meaningful negotiations. So we did have many issues to discuss with Olmert. But on this particular story, you know, I'm with all due respect to the former Prime Minister, I don't think the story that he relayed was accurate. What he did in that particular meeting, which I recall, I didn't attend it, but I recall hearing the details of it afterwards. When he proposed a map, President Abbas asked him, show me a map. I mean, submit the map. And Olmert, from a distance across the table, he went with a piece of paper like that. And President Abbas was sitting about maybe 5-6 meters away. And he said, this is a map, in which he showed, you know, like, you know, the borders and the areas that they want to swap, et cetera, et cetera. And he didn't even give the map to the president. So following that meeting, we wrote a letter to the Israeli side, saying that we would like to get a copy, an official copy of your offer. We cannot respond to something verbal. We need something in writing. This is a document that you want to submit to us. And once it is submitted officially, we will give you an official response whether we accept it or we don't accept it. And we attached to that letter 14 different questions as a result of that particular meeting that you are talking about, in which we sought explanations from the Israeli side on the many issues that they brought up that touched on Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, borders, etc., etc., etc. Until today, we haven't received neither an official proposal from the Israelis nor an answer to these 14 questions. This is exactly what happened in that meeting.
We'll have to ask him your question next time he comes here. Last week there was an article in the New York Times that was headlined, Force has trumped diplomacy. And I just want to ask, Israel may feel today that as a result of its incursion in Gaza, in December, construction of the wall, and its occupation of the West Bank, that it has a relatively stable, secure situation. What's the advantage to Israel of negotiations with the PLO?
Well, first of all, I don't think this is an accurate assumption or conclusion that force has prevailed. If this is the case, Israel would be living in peace and security, and Israel still lacks both. Okay, and therefore, I don't know who wrote that article. I think it's someone who is trying to advocate the delaying tactics of the existing government of not moving forward or not engaging the Palestinians. I don't think that the Israelis will achieve peace and security if they continue with their existing policies. And the Palestinian people are there to stay. We made mistakes in 1948 and 1967. We are not going to repeat those mistakes again. So whatever Israel does in terms of demolishing homes, confiscating land, building settlements, revoking identity cards of Palestinian residents of Jerusalem, preventing Palestinians from entering their country of birth, anything they can do is not going to force the Palestinians to move or mass immigrate from Palestine. And we are there to stay. And, you know, the longer they delay the resolution of this conflict, the stronger the extremists on both sides will become. And now you have a pragmatic Palestinian leadership which is willing to accommodate and accept the 22% of Palestine, historic Palestine, as a future home for the Palestinian people. 22%, 78% will go for Israel. What we are seeing right now, an Israeli government who wants to bargain with us on the 22%. They want to split it so that we can get 11% and they can end up with 89%. And we are not going to bargain anymore. We have made that historical compromise in 1988 when we recognized Israel's right to exist. And I think we are entitled for an independent, sovereign, viable state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip with Jerusalem as its, East Jerusalem as its capital. This administration, the Obama administration, made it clear that this goal is in the national security interest of the United States of America. For the first time ever, you see an administration saying that the creation of a Palestinian state that can live side by side with Israel in peace and security is of the highest national interest security of the United States. Now, if this administration doesn't see things in the right angle, I wonder if the writer of that article can do better than that. But I think this is the only way out of instability and conflict in the region.
When you arrived in the United States to head up the mission, you spoke with great hope of the new Obama administration, as I recall. And the Fatah government has issued just in the past week a press release in which they indicated that the Obama administration, hopes in the Obama administration, have evaporated. They accused the White House of caving into pressure from the Zionist lobby, backing off a demand that Israel free settlement construction, et cetera, et cetera. How does the PLO expect to move toward peace if it doesn't if it doesn't relate well to, if it doesn't place its faith in President Obama, George Mitchell, and the negotiators?
Well, first of all, we are an open democratic society. You cannot ask people to agree with all your policies. I mean, some people will disagree, and they are entitled for that. You know, I've seen this report, and You know, it's a reflection of maybe impatience on the part of the Palestinian people. They were hoping that things will happen fast. I think it's also a reflection of the sense of urgency that we can, you know, time is running out. We need to move quickly on all of these issues. And I continue to have faith in the current Obama administration. I think they have been in government for 9 months now. We waited with the previous administrations for 4 years and 5 years before they got engaged, not at the level of the president and the best Middle East team assembled since the Carter administration. I think we should give them the benefit of the doubt. We should give them some more time to contemplate their future steps. But time is of the essence here. We need to really move quickly, because if we don't find a solution soon, as I said earlier, this will only embolden extremists on both sides to try to undermine the prospects of reaching a peaceful agreement.
Former Prime Minister Olmert last week also talked about Iran as being the most critical issue in the Middle East, and said that almost all of the countries in the Middle East would agree that they are deeply concerned about Iran and critical of its progress toward nuclear military power. Hamas has been supported by Iran. How does the PLO take, what's its position on Iran?
Well, we don't have the best of relations with Iran. That's no secret. And largely due to the fact that we sometimes get the sense that they meddle, they interfere in Palestinian internal affairs. And on the issue of the nuclear armament of Iran, I think one needs to view it in the larger context of the whole Middle East area. Is it a secret that Israel has a nuclear arsenal? Why nobody is talking about the nuclear arsenal of Israel? Why is nobody saying that let's try to achieve a Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction, like the Arabs, the Egyptians, the Syrians, and the other Arab countries are proposing? Why is it when it comes to Israel, nobody wants to see Israel comply with international agreements and treaties? I think nobody should be allowed to possess nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction, but we have to have a very even-handed and equal approach to the issue to make the Middle East a region, an area free of all weapons of mass destruction.
And now, Mr. Arkad, it's time to turn to questions from the audience.
Sure.
They have several. Let me start by asking, how can there be peace between Palestine and Israel before there is peace within Palestine itself?
That's a very good, is that the end of the question?
Yes.
That's a very good question. I think this is why we are trying very hard to end the division among the Palestinians. And I think that what we have witnessed in the last 3 years is a very painful chapter in the history of our people. Very painful because it physically divided the same people from each other, and definitely undermined our ability to defend the interests of our people. I think that we should soon, today, before tomorrow, try to put an end to these divisions and focus on preserving the national interests of the Palestinian people in order to advance our struggle for independence and freedom. We are doing that in parallel to trying to negotiate with the Israelis, but our leadership said many times before that if we reach an agreement with the Israeli side, that we will put such an agreement to a public referendum for all the Palestinians to vote on it, that we will not sign an agreement with Israel before the Palestinian people, both inside Palestine and in the diaspora, approve such an agreement with Israel. And I think this is one way to guarantee and to assure the Palestinians that the leadership is not going to accept or sign an agreement because the Palestinian supports such an agreement.
Does that mean that there will not be an agreement between the representatives at any time, or that an agreement will
You need to ratify it. You need to, I mean, it's if you can if by that time we have Palestine National Council, we have the political vehicles needed to ratify an agreement that will be acceptable by all the segments of the Palestinian people, then we will do it through one vehicle. But if you don't have that and the Palestinians are dispersed all over, then you have to present it to them for a public referendum for approval. Every treaty must be ratified.
Has President Obama done enough to negotiate peace between the Israelis and Palestine, and will his recent Nobel Peace Prize be an incentive to negotiate peace even more
vigorously?
Seriously.
Well, I did answer that earlier when I said that the fact that they got engaged early in the process, that he appointed Senator Mitchell a few days after he took over, were clear signals of an early engagement. We also receive assurances all the time that the president personally is committed to the resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that it is a top priority on his agenda, and that he would like to see that conflict resolved during his presidency. We believe that he is genuine, he is sincere, the administration is genuine and sincere, but again, there are so many things that need to be worked out. We need to know what are the terms of reference for any future political process, what is the structure and the format and the time frame of the process or the meetings, and thirdly, what is the end game? We have wasted so much time talking about the process from our past experiences. We believe that we exhausted negotiations. Basically, the Israelis know our position on Jerusalem as much as we know their position on Jerusalem, and so forth for the other issues. So I don't think we need another year of negotiations. What we need is probably a short period of time to make the decision and reach the agreement. I don't think we should waste our time in talking about negotiations and about another process. What we need to focus on a meaningful rounds of meetings that will focus on the substance and lead to decisions and resolutions of all these issues.
You mentioned future Palestinian soil. Could you describe, in your view, the geographic area and boundaries of a Palestinian state?
It will be the 1967, all the Palestinian territory that was occupied in 1967, that includes East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. Now, it's no secret that we have contemplated the idea of minor modifications, adjustments to the borders, which will be equal in quantity and quality. And, we are receptive to that idea, given that the exchange will be equal, not like what the Israelis offered us in Camp David of 2000, 1-9. They will take 9 square kilometers in return for 1 square kilometer. It has to be equal in quality and quantity. If they want to take a chunk of land in the heart of the West Bank, they have to give us a mirror piece of land on their side. They cannot give us a piece of land in the Negev desert for that. So we are talking about the territory that was occupied in 1967.
Why don't you talk a little bit more about the other conditions that you're interested in, the other issues, refugee return, Jerusalem, and some of the others?
Well, on the refugees, I think the Arab Peace Initiative that was introduced at the Arab Summit in March 2002 in Beirut, Lebanon, and then it was the Saudi initiative, and then it became the Arab Peace Initiative. The language on the refugees there is a very creative and I think very reasonable language when it said that a just resolution to the Palestinian refugee problem based on UN General Assembly 194 to be agreed. And then, they put a dot or full stop after that. To be agreed, of course, they mean to be agreed with the Israeli side. I think in order to end this conflict, you have to satisfy the Palestinian demand when it comes to the refugees. Now, one can also think realistically and say that, you know, demographically, you know, allowing 6 million Palestinian refugees to return to Israel would mean that Israel will vanish, and this is one very major concern for the Israelis. President Yasser Arafat, the late president, published an op-ed, I believe it was in 2000 or 2001 in the New York Times, in which he said that the Palestinians understand the demographic concerns of Israel, but the crux of the problem in the Palestinian-Israel problem is the Palestinian refugees. The people who were either forced or to leave their homes or left their homes out of fear for their safety, you have to put to find out a creative, just solution for the plight of the Palestinian refugees. The creation of the state of Palestine, allowing a large number of these refugees to become citizens of that state, would be one way to satisfy the resolution of the refugee problem. But you have also to look at the Palestinian right of return. You have to look at the Palestinian right for restitution, for compensation. UN General Assembly Resolution 194 says compensation not only for those who don't choose to return, but also those who choose to return and they are allowed to return to their homes before the creation of the State of Israel are also entitled for compensation. But again, there will be a lot of creativity involved there. We want to put an end to the conflict and an end to the historical claims, which means that we want also to reach an accommodation with Israel that will allow for both states to live in peace and security side by side with each other. And we don't want to create any additional problems for each one of us.
Please tell us a little bit about the role of women in the PLO. Are they significant? Do they have a full role?
Not as supposed to. I don't think that the recent elections of the Revolutionary Council and the Central Council managed to bring on any new women leaders, unfortunately, with the exception of Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, who is a very well-known figure joining the PLO's executive committee. We haven't seen a fair representation of Palestinian women equal to their contribution in the Palestinian society. And this is sometimes puzzles me. I can't understand why they don't manage to reach the top ranks.
Tell us a little bit about the Fatah meeting, first in 20 years. Tell us about what happened there, who participated, and the new leadership.
Well, first of all, the mere fact that this conference was held was an achievement by itself. I think it produced many results in August. One allowed supporters of Fatah to gather and express their views and opinions. For 20 years, they haven't had this chance to do it. So the fact that they all assembled and aired their views in private and in public, in meetings, was a very significant development. Secondly, it also presented Fatah as a credible Palestinian political party after the divisions, after the conflict with Hamas and losing control of Gaza in 2006, Fatah was weakened. And to many Palestinians, they no longer represented an alternative to Hamas or to other factions, that they were weak, they were corrupt, mismanagement, etc. I think it was a good opportunity for them to prove that they can be a credible political party that can represent Palestinian aspirations and Palestinian interests. And finally, I think it asserted the leadership of President Mahmoud Abbas, who even, you know, among his own Fatah organizations, many were trying to question his leadership, and he emerged as a strong leader of Fatah and a strong leader of the Palestinian people as a result of the Fatah conference in August.
You mentioned the reputation for corruption. Has that changed significantly over the last several years?
Well, it's isolated incidents, but unfortunately, like in mathematics, you know, you need many proofs to prove a theory, and one proof to disprove it. And I think the Palestinian people, it has been exaggerated, all these instances of mismanagement and corruption. But unfortunately, you know, because we live in a very transparent society, you know, when something happens, everybody knows about it. And it does hurt those who are sincere and are perseverant, and they want to serve the people. And therefore, I believe now, with all the measures that the government of Prime Minister Fayyad has established, the transparency and accountability, we see a very minimum, if any, of these cases compared to the past.
You spoke of the mistakes and missteps of the PLO and Fatah. Why should Palestinians, especially in the diaspora, trust or put their faith in the PLO or the authority?
You know, for those who are doubtful, for those who have suspicions, let them put faith in the people and in the cause. They don't need to put their faith in either or either one of them. But this should not be a reason, with all due respect to this view, should not be reason to sit and not do anything. I think what we have back home is an unfortunate case that we are working diligently to put an end to that division. But this should not be a reason for Palestinians in the diaspora not to be active and not to support the Palestinian cause and not to support the struggle of their people and not to impact the decision-making process in this country in order to influence the foreign policy of the United States of America. I think, you know, we can find a common denominator for Palestinians here and in the diaspora to work based on it and to try to serve their people and help their people back home to end their divisions.
AIPAC has been very effective in the United States in support of Israel. Is there a Palestinian lobby, and is it effective?
I mean, you know, we always wanted to see something similar. We try to learn a lot from the experience of the pro-Israel groups everywhere. And I think, unfortunately, once again, because the political polarization here and the disappointments, the disillusionments over time, we haven't seen a united effort to create such a strong pro-Palestinian lobby in the United States. But it's never too late. I think if we can manage to once again unite the efforts and the work of all these various groups and organizations among the community here in the diaspora, that the opportunity is still there. What we need is we need to unite our efforts.
Many think that Marwan Barghouti, who is locked in an Israeli jail, will be the next leader of Palestine and a Mandela-like figure. Do you agree?
I cannot. It's not that I agree or don't agree. I respect Marwan Barghouti. I think he... By spending time in jail, he has sacrificed many years of his life as a price for resisting the Israeli occupation and defending the rights of his people. But some people can agree, some people can disagree on this notion. And if he ever runs for election, I think the people will decide.
Amnesty International this week issued a report on water the region. And the person in the audience asks, what water resources exist in the West Bank and Gaza, and who controls the water, and how will water be controlled in the future?
Under Israeli occupation, the Israeli military controlled water in the West Bank and Gaza. Drilling wells for irrigation purposes was prohibited without obtaining a military permit. And many farmers lost their farms and lost their incomes as a result because of the Israeli policies. When the Palestinians engaged the Israelis before Oslo, they wanted to put the water as part of the interim agreement of 1993. But they couldn't agree with the Israelis on that because water is a vital interest for Israel. The location of most of the settlements in the West Bank are deliberately chosen to sit on top of Palestinian water aquifers, and most of these settlements, the expansion of these settlements, goes with the stretch of these water aquifers in the West Bank. Israel uses our water. They take our water and they sell it to us, and there is no equal distribution of water in the West Bank. Israeli settlers in the West Bank, I don't want to tell you in terms of numbers, but they use many, many, many times the daily allowance that is given to the Palestinians. Water shortages is a common thing in the Palestinian areas. Now we have a Palestinian water authority meet with the Israelis on a daily basis to try to somehow convince the Israelis to allow more distribution of water to the Palestinian population. But this is one issue of the permanent status issues, and the Palestinian position on that is very much relying on international law. The international law clearly defines the rights of parties in conflict over these issues. So it's a very clear issue, and we will follow international law in any future agreement on this issue.
What are Hamas's incentives for cooperating with Fatah, or for not cooperating with Fatah?
What are Hamas's incentives?
What are their incentives, right? Why should they?
It's the same incentive that Fatah has to cooperate with Hamas, to reunite the Palestinian people, and to establish a united front to protect the national interests of the Palestinian people. I don't think there should be any other incentives than that.
Israel continues to build a physical wall, and what is the PLO doing to stop the building of the wall?
Well, in terms of having the power and the ability to stop Israel, unfortunately, we don't have the capability, on the ground to force Israel to stop, but we have done a lot to do that. We took the issue of the wall to the International Court of Justice, and they issued in 2000, I believe it was five, the advisory in which they considered the wall to be illegitimate, and the settlements as a result to be illegitimate. And we are resorting to many international forums and fora in order to support our position. We continue to talk to our friends all over the world about that, to talk to Israeli groups and Israeli political factions and parties about the dangerous policies of the Israeli government and how that will contribute to increasing the tension in the region. And we will continue to do whatever we can in order to stop these Israeli settlements, Israeli policies, I'm sorry.
And as far as settlements are concerned, your position is that there should be no growth of the settlements at all?
Our position, these settlements must be dismantled. This is our position. And for the resumption of negotiations or political talks with the Israelis, we are asking that Israel freezes all settlement activities, including natural growth, including in East Jerusalem. And this is the issue where the administration, unfortunately, failed to achieve with the Israelis when they announced that it will be a cornerstone of their approach to resuming these political contacts between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But the Palestinian position vis-à-vis settlements in general, these are illegitimate, illegal, and they should be dismantled without any exception.
And just going back to Jerusalem, you did mention that it should be the future capital, but the conditions that Olmert outlined to your president, are those conditions that are generally acceptable in terms of?
I cannot elaborate on what Prime Minister Olmert said, or what could have been his own interpretation of what he explained to the president. I wasn't present when he was discussing that with President Abbas. But from the feedback we got from our leadership on these negotiations, we continue to insist that the pre-1967 Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, should be the capital of the future Palestinian state. Now, we understand the special status of the old city, and we understand that Muslims, Christians, and Jews must have the right to worship, and they have access to their holy sites. And we have said that we are willing to discuss a creative arrangement to the old city. You use the word the Holy Basin, by the way, and I just want to tell you that we don't agree to that. You know, when we talk only about the confined old city surrounded by the old walls of Jerusalem. We do not talk about the Holy Basin, because in Israel's interpretation, the Holy Basin extends to Silwan, extends to the Mount of Olive, and it goes much beyond the old city. So what we are talking about, only the old city. The old city, we are willing to find an arrangement where we can once again, you know, allow the followers of the three faiths to really exercise their religious duties and responsibilities. Right today, Christians and Muslims are not allowed to enter Jerusalem and visit their holy sites. Contrary to what the Israelis are saying, there is no freedom of religion in Jerusalem today. So we are creative about the issue of the old city. But the pre-1967 Jerusalem, on the eve of the June War of 1967, that's the territory that we are asking to be returned to the Palestinians to become the capital of future Palestinian state.
Clearly, all Palestinians are not Muslim. Many are Christians. What is the role of Christians today? Do they have full rights in Palestinian leadership? Let me leave it at that.
I never heard of any cases of discrimination against our Christian brothers in Palestine. I'm surprised that this issue is being raised. The Palestinian Christians are part and parcel of the Palestinian people. We don't have any issue with the.
And in leadership?
Of course they are. I mean, you know, we have to, I don't want to talk about that, because we are not used to talking about that. I mean, we have two Christian ministers in the cabinet. In the elections of 1996, the late President Yasser Arafat assigned 6 seats out of the 88 seats in the Palestinian Legislative Council to Palestinian Christians. And they have very prominent positions both in the government, the public sector, the academia, the private sector, and well respected. And there is no cases of discrimination against Christians in Palestine, not as far as I know.
There has been some talk recently turning from a two-state solution to a one-state solution. What's your view on it? Is it a viable solution?
Our strategic position remains a two-state solution. Now, we understand that because of the difficulties facing us in achieving that goal, and because of the continued Israeli policies of imposing facts on the ground, trying to preempt and make the creation of a Palestinian state a very difficult task, many have been saying that we should opt for the ones by national state. But the PLO's position, the Palestinian official position, remains a two-state solution, Palestine and Israel living side by side in peace and security.
What's the biggest myth that the American people have about the Mideast conflict?
What's the biggest myth? Wow, well, they have more than one myth, I believe, you know, so it's going to be difficult to answer that. But I would say that Israel is a democracy and the Palestinians and the Arabs are not democratic. I think this is one of the worst myths that exist in this country, because it either shows ignorance, lack of knowledge, or not understanding the situation. I don't think the Palestinians and the Arabs are less democratic than the Israelis or any other nation in the West. It's just the political circumstances that make things more difficult there, and sometimes does not help them present themselves accurately to the outside world. But this is one of the really the most serious myths to try to consider that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East and that the Palestinians and the Arabs cannot be democratic.
Mr. Arkat, we are now at the last question. You may be happy to know that. And the question is, you've been negotiating now for well over a decade. You've been involved in negotiations. What keeps you going, and why are you still optimistic?
I can say simply hope, but I think people are getting tired of that word. I think thinking of the alternative of not talking. If you just sit and don't talk and let events on the ground lead you. And we have learned in the Middle East or in Palestine, Israel, that tomorrow is going to be worse than today. And today is worse than yesterday. Tomorrow is not a better day. In the West here, in this country, people say, oh, tomorrow is another day, it's going to be better. No, things there get always difficult and more complicated. And I think, you know, thinking of the alternative, thinking of what will happen if you don't try to sort out this conflict and continue to talk to people who believe in the same objective and the same goal. This is, I think, the fundamental reason that keep us all going, seeking the best for our people, because we Palestinians are paying the heaviest price for the lack of peace. We are the ones who are suffering. We are the ones whom their national identity has been taken and threatened. So we are the ones who will gain the most from having peace. And that's why we want to continue to exert our best efforts to achieve that. The same thing for the Israelis, I think. The Israelis must understand that this is a win-win situation, that neither party has to emerge a loser or a winner alone, you know, that we both can emerge as winners. And I hope that this Israeli leadership will show some political far-sightedness and think about the future, that we are there to stay, they are there to stay. The best thing is to accommodate and not to try to prolong the conflict.
Well.
Clearly, Mr. Arkat, the audience has expressed to you their appreciation for your informing us, sharing your points of view and your optimism. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I just want to say thanks to you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.